Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you like it, please share it. Leave us a review where you found it. It really helps us out. You can also find recipes and videos and information on just about everything else you hear today on our website, splendidtable.org. But right now, let's get to this week's show, hosted by Lynn Rosetto Casper.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. Anthony Bourdain has built not your usual celebrity chef's career. Dubbed food's bad boy, he's part iconoclast and part the canny observer. On his CNN show, Parts Unknown, he brings out the realities of how people eat and how they live and think. It could be in a stunning little-known part of France or a war zone in Beirut. He's constantly on the road, except when he's home. And that's when he cooks for family and friends, which led to his latest cookbook, Appetites. Tony Bourdain, it's great to have you back with us. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
So, okay, we've got a family cookbook that you've done.
Yes.
But you know, I have to laugh, okay, because the family cookbook has duck fat, wild boar. There's about four tubs of different stocks in the fridge. So tell me about how you cook at home.
Well, I have a very unusual, or I thought I had an unusual sort of non-nuclear dysfunctional extended family. I mean, my house is a sort of an absentee wife who pretty much abandoned me to become a professional jiu-jitsu and grappling expert, a daughter and a nine-year-old girl who grew up eating very adventurously, largely, I think, maybe because her mother's Italian and she was exposed to those kinds of food. A Filipino nanny and her son, who is my daughter's, essentially in all important ways but blood, my little girl's brother and best friend, and an extended family of Filipinos, visiting Brazilians and various grapplers and martial arts professionals, as well as a bunch of other knuckleheads coming in and out. So I found myself for the last 9 years cooking in a way, or cooking things that I really never did as a professional, and trying to, you know, live the role of the patriarch. So, I mean, this book reflects a guy who spent 30 years in the restaurant business who is now preparing school lunches for his little girl and, you know, cooking Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners for this big, dysfunctional, messy group of people. And I think, though the food is fairly straightforward, I don't want to give the impression that it's unapproachable. And there's also meatloaf and macaroni and cheese and the sort of thing a nine-year-old would like. I do bring up, you know, the kind of organizational skills to it that I picked up over all those years. I mean, I've cooked a lot of Thanksgivings professionally, and you know what I've learned, I think, would be very, very helpful to people who struggle with a big holiday meal and find themselves, you know, not even remembering eating because there's so much work involved.
Well, give me, for instance, with Thanksgiving, because this is the perennial question: how do I survive?
Yeah. Well, for a professional, Thanksgiving's a three-day operation. I mean, you make the cranberry relish 2 days in advance. It only gets better. You don't struggle. We don't make gravy in the pan. That never works. You know, where you deglaze the pan with water or flour, and supposedly you have some magical gravy. Who does that? You make a turkey stock, and then maybe you incorporate the drippings. You know, and you do that on the day before, perhaps. Again, it's something that improves over by sitting and marrying up. And then most importantly, you don't carve the turkey at the table. I always prepare what I call a stunt turkey. You know, a small turkey that I roast and actually stuff, which I advise against actually stuffing your turkey. You know, I cook the stuffing on the side like I do in the restaurant. It's healthier and it's better and more controllable. But basically, I make a stunt turkey for display. And I show everybody the turkey with the little paper booties on it and the stuffing inside. They all go, ooh and ah. And then I whisk that back into the kitchen for myself for leftovers and turkey sandwiches tomorrow, which is what Thanksgiving's really all about as far as I'm concerned. And then I have my service turkey, which is a big turkey, which I take the breast off the bone. I remove all of the the thigh and the drumstick. And, you know, I slice that breast into nice, attractive shingles, lay it out on my separately cooked stuffing, and mm-hmm. I send out an immaculate-looking platter of portion-controlled, ready-to-go, you know, cookbook-ready turkey that people can actually eat. I'm not up there wrestling with this turkey, struggling to hack off a few pieces of scrawny white meat, you know, for people who are, you know, your turkey's getting cold while the other guy is, you know, waiting for me to figure out how to carve turkey off the bone at the table side without stabbing myself. In this way, you also ensure that everybody gets some white meat, some dark meat, whatever they like, because it's worth remembering that the murder rates spike enormously over the holidays, and I think a lot of that is turkey-related.
Yeah, probably. I wonder, too, about the fact that people get together over the holidays that maybe haven't chosen to be there.
Yeah. This is a situation that's fraught with peril. And there's probably all sorts of simmering resentments going on. So you should be able to spend as much time at the table as possible. And you should be organized. It should be a pretty painless operation if you organize yourself correctly. And I think those kinds of realistic expectations, you know, when you throw a dinner party, you should be able to, A, enjoy the meal yourself, and B, spend time with your guests. You shouldn't be stirring risotto in the kitchen for 22 minutes while, you know, your guests are getting, you know, sort of bitter and drunk waiting for their food.
Well, there is something you say that sort of stopped me for a moment. You say you really hate to admit that for you, there's more stress in cooking for a party of five at home than cranking out meals for 500 in a restaurant.
Much easier for me. I mean, I can crank out 500 turkey dinners standing on my head, but Thanksgiving, you know, five family members with all of that, you know, all that backstory coming, and or five anybody. I get nervous. So I have my prep and my mise en place. I am squared away.
Tony, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Anthony Bourdain is author of the cookbook Appetites. Look for his macaroni and cheese recipe. It is comfort food season, after all. And you're going to find that on the website at splendidtable.org. Without exaggeration, I can say Jancis Robinson is a living legend. The woman is a wine authority in capital letters. She's accumulated a string of awards with her wine books, which have a tendency to run about 1,000 pages each. So imagine the reactions when she came out with a little pocket-sized book, 24-Hour Wine Expert. Really? Become a wine expert in 24 hours? Look, if this works, it's pure gold for the holidays. Contributor Russ Parsons put her to the test.
Jancis Robinson, welcome to Splendid Table.
Thank you.
The American Thanksgiving table is full of all of these paradoxical flavors. You know, the sweet tart cranberries, roasted turkey, vegetables, stuffing can make wine pairing a real chore. This is one of those kind of evergreen questions, but do you have any new insights to add to it?
Only that I think that too much is made of wine pairing, even when you've got a simple dish, which Thanksgiving food certainly isn't. I hate it when people are made to feel they must strive to find the absolutely perfect match. Because if you get a wine that's not absolutely perfect with your food, what's the worst that can happen? You know, no thunderbolt from on high comes down to strike you dead. You can have a glass of water in between the mouthful of wine and the mouthful of food, or a little nibble on something neutral like bread. You know, but it really doesn't matter as much as I think some people suggest.
Well, that's a relief. This is also the start of kind of the holiday gift-giving season. And these days, with wine so popular, it seems like, you know, when you're stumped for something to get for someone, wine is kind of the default answer. So let's run through a couple of possible scenarios. What would be the best bottles to get for someone who knows a lot about wine, whom you'd like to impress? And conversely, what kinds of wines would you avoid in that case?
In general, I would say for a wine buff, the gold currency is probably an absolutely top champagne, because no one has an excess of Cristal or Dom Perignon, for instance. You know, it's always, I don't know anyone for whom it wouldn't be a treat. to have a bottle of one of the most luxurious champagnes. And also, funnily enough, thinking about a more routine gift, not just the Thanksgiving gift, but something, bottles that are often given between wine professionals are bottles of really tip-top olive oil, just because, you know, we come across so much wine in our everyday lives that this is something out of the ordinary. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I love the idea of olive oil because it's something in common with wine and with a wine table, but you don't have cases of it stacked up at home waiting to taste.
Exactly.
There's no obligation implied.
Yeah, and if you can supply a little story with it, you know, about the estate that it was grown on or something, then so much the better.
Another perennial problem at this time of year, you're asked to bring a bottle to a party. You know, you want something nice, but you know this isn't the right situation to do something really special. What kind of wine would you bring for that?
Well, I would say in that instance, then something a little bit out of the ordinary that you know something about. Like from, you know, there are certain wine regions and wine producing countries even that are making fabulous wine at the moment, but aren't getting their full due in this country. Like, for instance, Chile is making some great wine, as is South Africa. And yet both those countries seem in the US to be tarnished with a slightly downmarket image. So I would go to my local wine retailer and say, can you recommend an interesting wine from the Southern Hemisphere and tell me a little bit of a story about it? They won't be desperately expensive, but they'll be infinitely more exciting than anything you'll pull off the bottom shelf in a supermarket.
Oh, that's a great suggestion.
And I always say that there are such strong parallels between booksellers and wine retailers and a knowledge about the product. And if you want to learn more about wine without investing masses of time in a wine course or something, establish a relationship with a local wine retailer. Go and tell them what you've liked so far, as you would say with a bookseller, you know, I like these books, what else can you recommend? And it's in the wine retailer's interest to recommend something that's like what you've liked, but a little bit more interesting or better value or something like that, and really cultivate that relationship.
Somewhat along those same lines, you know, if you're giving a party, you want to have a couple of cases of something quaffable because you know people are going to be drinking and not paying all that much attention, sipping and swirling. What kinds of wines are you looking for?
I would say you're looking for wines which are perennially underpriced, probably, in that, because I'm a strong believer in the fact that there is no direct correlation between wine quality and the price. There are overpriced wines and there are underpriced wines. And at the moment, underpriced wines, which are really, really easy to drink, would include Muscadet, that rather old-fashioned French wine from the Atlantic coast, which has been overlooked for many, many years, but is undergoing a bit of a quality revolution at the moment. But the prices haven't zoomed up. And you can find actually quite mature wines at good prices. So Muscadet would be a good white wine that is a kind of please-all, really. And it'll probably carry the name of a small domain on the label. So it kind of looks smarter, perhaps, than its price. And then the red wine equivalent of that could be Beaujolais. You know, we all went mad about Beaujolais Nouveau a decade or two ago and rather spoilt the reputation and image of Beaujolais. But it's got over that Nouveau thing, and it's now making better and better wine with real fruit and concentration and integrity to it. And again, underpriced because it's been unfashionable, and will probably carry a rather nice label that will look much smarter than it is.
Oh, that's great. So I've always wondered about this. As someone who tastes dozens of wines a day in the course of your trade.
Dozens, my dear chap. Hundreds.
What are you drinking for pleasure now?
It's so varied. I like roaming over the world of wine. But I suppose one constant, I've always loved Riesling. In fact, occasionally someone will say to me, what's it like having power in the world of wine? And I always say, I've been writing about wine for 40 years, and for 40 years I've been saying Riesling is the greatest white wine grape in the world, and it still doesn't sell. I know mine is a minority taste, but Riesling is fabulous because it communicates place, it lasts forever, much longer than a Chardonnay or a Sauvignon Blanc, for instance, and develops and gets better, and it's brilliant with food. Whereas a lot of these bigger, heavier, oakier wines are quite domineering. They don't get the saliva flowing, you know. They can be more difficult to flatter food.
That's wonderful. Jancis Robinson, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Jancis Robinson is a master of wine and author of The 24-Hour Wine Expert. Russ Parsons is a longtime food writer and author of the classic How to Pick a Peach. Jancis gave us information from the book that could very well get you through the holiday season. It runs from matching wine to the occasion to crowd pleasers and bottles as gifts. Check it all out at splendidtable.org. It's a literal clearinghouse of information. Coming up, celebrating the southern sweet potato and harvesting wild rice in northern Minnesota. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Vivian Howard is a new breed of celebrity chef. Her TV show, A Chef's Life, won both Peabody and James Beard Awards. It's an anything but glossy look at the realities of running a high-end restaurant while raising a young family and managing a rapidly growing culinary career. Vivian's home base is in eastern North Carolina, a place with some very specific ingredients and unique cooking traditions. Vivian's first book is Deep Run Roots, Stories and Recipes from My Corner of the South. Contributor Shauna Seaver recently got a chance to talk with Vivian.
Hi, Vivian. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first, let's just say that your book has a presence. It is impressive. 564 pages. It's about 4 pounds. You look like a movie star on the cover. It's incredible. And even more intriguing when you realize that this isn't another cookbook about the entire American South. It's actually a laser focus on this area of eastern North Carolina. So how many square miles are we talking about?
The coastal plain is about 100 square miles.
Wow.
Which is not big.
No.
But when you think about, you know, lots of our most vibrant culinary regions in the world, like, you know, Tuscany or Provence, we're also not talking about a large swath of land when we talk about those places. Eastern North Carolina is a very rural place. It continues to be a rural place when so much of our country is changing. Eastern North Carolina has not changed that much. And, you know, as a kid, I had very little exposure to other ingredients, the ingredients that don't show up in the book. So that's really what our diet in eastern North Carolina revolves around, you know, these fruits like blueberries and watermelon and apples and figs and vegetables like collards and turnips and sweet potatoes and sweet corn. And so that's really what I grew up eating. That's what the people of my region eat. And that's what I've always had to design my menu at my restaurant around. So I don't know how else to cook or write about food except in that context.
So you mentioned sweet potatoes. Let's talk about that. It's a very humble ingredient, but there are certainly lots of different kinds, yams versus sweet potatoes. It can be a little confusing when you're at the market. So what kind of sweet potatoes are we talking about?
I'm talking about the kind of red-skinned, orange-fleshed sweet potato. That's actually not a yam. A yam would be like a starchier, often white root, probably from the Caribbean. But I'm talking about a sweet potato that is orange and not starchy. And often the variety that we see the most is a Beauregard.
I was amazed how many sweet potatoes in America come from eastern North Carolina.
Yeah, I think it's something like two-thirds of all the sweet potatoes grown in the states are grown within like this 100-mile radius. And for that reason, sweet potatoes are really a cornerstone of our cuisine.
A defining ingredient, definitely. And going that route of getting specific about ingredients in cookbooks can often lead to a lot of food writing cliches, comparing food to people, a sort of overly romantic sort of way of writing. But you actively avoid that, except in the case of sweet potatoes. Tell us about your Grandma Hill and her candied sweet potatoes.
Yeah, you know, I so badly did not want my book to be about all the lovely people in my past and comparing them to, you know, comparing my dad to a turnip or whatever. But my grandma is, my grandmother Hill, you know, did everything in moderation. You know, she was not warm and fuzzy. She didn't make really sweet desserts. And, you know, her candied yams perfectly represented her pragmatic way of living. You know, I think when we think of candied yams, generally we think of torched marshmallows and lots of brown sugar and butter oozing, you know, from every crevice. But hers were just roasted sweet potatoes, sliced and baked with a little bit of cinnamon and nutmeg and just a little bit of brown sugar and a little butter. And as a kid, I remember always wanting more of all of those things. And coincidentally, I always wanted more from my grandma. You know, I wanted her to, like, you know, bounce me on her knee and tell me I was beautiful and love me, you know, really, really tenderly. And that was just not her way. So she is the sweet potato.
So, nothing marshmallowy about her. No marshmallows in that situation.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And I loved this story about the sweet potato pan being in the home kitchens of the women that you grew up with.
Yeah, you know, my Grandma Hill, my Grandma Iris, and my mom, you know, always we had a sweet potato pan. And sweet potatoes were something that we cooked every day or every other day. And my mom just covered that pan in a paper bag and put 3 or 4 sweet potatoes on it and roasted them in the oven in their jacket. And then when they were done, they just stayed in the oven. You know, she turned the oven off, but they sat there until we used them. And they were just a mainstay, kind of a convenience food.
A real grab-and-go everyday food, kind of like we'd grab a protein bar now. You have
right.
You could take a sweet potato.
The first kind bar, I guess. My grandfather, every day after lunch, left with a sweet potato in his pocket. And it was, you know, his afternoon snack.
I love that. So say we have this. We do the batch roasting of the sweet potatoes. What are 3 ways we could use them for dinner tonight?
So I love, I make soup a lot. And so when I have these roasted sweet potatoes, I'll just peel the jacket off and cut it into chunks and then throw it in the soup. And it thickens it up instead of adding, you know, like a roux or cream. And it adds a pleasant background sweetness. I also make my kids, I'm a vegetable hider. I never thought I'd be that person, but I am.
I know.
And I make things like turkey burgers or meatloaf, and I'll fold some of that sweet potato into it, and it makes it moist, and it also adds a nice, pleasant flavor. And then I love to just split that roasted sweet potato in half, and I'll dot like a little bit of red miso and a little bit of butter. We'll sprinkle some sunflower seeds on there with some flaky sea salt and heat that gently in the oven. And that's like a meal in itself. And it's nice because you can customize it for every member of your family. My husband loves to saute, you know, turnip greens because they've got a little bit of bitterness and a little bit of sausage and put that on top of a roasted sweet potato. So they're just incredibly versatile. And if you already have them roasted, they're incredibly convenient.
Wow, those are some great ideas. Let's talk about a special occasion dinner, Thanksgiving. I imagine the sweet potatoes on your Thanksgiving table are pretty impressive. What are you going to be doing with your sweet potatoes this year?
Well, every year we make my Grandma Hill's candied yams just because it's like having her at Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. But I also make like a tostone, so I'll slice them, boil them just till they're barely tender, and then smash them, and then pan fry them, and they get really nice and crunchy around the edges. And then I'll make a syrup with Chinese 5-spice and bacon and drizzle that over top of the crispy sweet potatoes. And that's been a huge crowd pleaser in years past. And so I'll probably make that this year. It's also great for breakfast. If you're having a Thanksgiving breakfast, it's very satisfying.
That sounds amazing. Well, thank you so much, Vivian. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Vivian Howard is author of Deep Run Roots and creator of PBS's A Chef's Life. Shauna Seaver is author of Real Sweet. And just in time for Thanksgiving, Vivian is sharing her sweet potato wisdom and that recipe for Grandma Hill's candied yams. You're going to find them both at splendidtable.org. It comes in many forms: milled, red, aromatic, sticky, and it's a staple for more than half the world. We're talking about rice. Now, the United States grows tons of it commercially every year, but there's a native plant in Minnesota that's been harvested in a very specific and traditional way for generations. Producer Jenny Cecil Moore brings us this story.
So you can see it's clean. I mean, this rice is very clean, but you need to just get off all that smoking and all these other processes. You can see it's cloudy, so we'll rinse it till it gets clear.
That's Marcia Levine. She's preparing wild rice from northern Minnesota.
Yeah, the rice has been on about 5 to 7 minutes, and you can already see that it's softening up. I want those grains to all open up, but I don't want them open for a long time so it gets mushy.
Marcia and Chuck Levine are Minnesotans who've spent time in the rural north of their state over the past 30 years.
The town where we've had our cabin is Nevis, Minnesota, basically midway between Fargo and Duluth.
Thousands of lakes dot this region, which is home to an indigenous grain, Minomin, or wild rice. It's an aquatic grass that grows in shallow waters. Levine has been active in the movement to recognize and protect the grain. It's ready for harvest in late August or September, and Levine experienced ricing firsthand.
One person is standing, pushing the canoe through the water, which may have a pretty soft bottom, and they don't use a regular paddle. They have something that looks more like duck feet. And the other person sits in the canoe and holds two wooden sticks, heavy wooden sticks, called knockers. The person harvesting puts their arms back, kind of like you're swinging a bat, pulls the rice down into the canoe. It's hard work.
Once the canoe is full, the rice is bagged and set aside for aging. Next, it will be hand parched, which is a simple processing method.
So it goes into a big drum that's rolling with a wood fire underneath it, so it gets a kind of toastiness to it.
This wild rice is considered an endangered food. It's among a few other foods in the U.S. that make up the Presidia, a designation of the Italian organization Slow Food Foundation for Biodiversity. Foods that qualify have been nominated by food producers and communities who actively protect a culturally significant food.
The Minomin, the good berry, that's a staple food of the Anishinaabe Ojibwe. It's part of our creation story. We view it as one of our most sacred gifts. It's actually a covenant between the individual and the creator on making sure that it's picked in a good way and used for the purposes and that it was intended to be used as a food and barter tool.
Dale Green works with the Native community on the Leech Lake Reservation in Cass Lake, Minnesota.
When I say my name, I'm telling you my Ojibwe spiritual name is Bidanaquit. That means approaching cloud. When I say Hmong Nindu Dame, it means my clan is the loon. And Missinanakwan Manominiki Nindun Jaba is I come from the island surrounded by wild rice, McGregor, Minnesota, the East Lake Refuge.
Green speaks Ojibwean and grew up on the lakes harvesting wild rice. He says it's a singular experience.
The silence is quite loud out there because the birds making their noise, the Minomin plant in the wind interreacting and singing for you, and of course the sloshing of the water that's alongside the canoe or the boat that just has its own rhythmic sound that is almost indescribable unless you've been able to enjoy it.
The tradition of ricing has greater importance than just as a source of food. For Native people in Minnesota, it's a way to impart shared values and cultural history.
The cultural practices that could be translated as being pro-social activities, you know, they have language associated with those activities, whether it's in Ojibwe English. The wild rice, maple sugaring, berry picking, it provides for morals and values. One person is speaking and passing them to another person, or more importantly, one generation to the next. When those cultural activities were outlawed and the people that practiced them became criminalized, it created a void. And like many things, when there's a void, something fills it.
Green is referring to drug and alcohol dependency, and even gang activity that emerged as cultural practices were banned by U.S. authorities.
If we can revalue the cultural activities, we're doing a major part of addressing those social ills that affect many of our families and communities by revaluing what we already have or what was given to us.
In addition to being culturally endangered, the rice has continually faced other threats. The damming of rivers and streams, which can cause flooding, mines that leak chemicals into the aquifers that feed the rice beds.
The most alarming thing is the pipelines. The rice beds are kind of an indicator of what could possibly go wrong with the pipelines. Any leakage is going to seep into the drinking water. Anything that happens upstream here will affect those downstream. It's just mind-boggling that in this place that we take for granted, the drinking water is being put at such a supreme risk.
Protecting these waterways is critical for the environment and for the region's cultural heritage. Although its story is tied to deep-rooted issues, the rice remains a simple pleasure.
I really just enjoy wild rice with a little maple sugar and blueberries, and that's the greatest taste in the world to me.
The grain goes well with almost anything. Marsha Levine has her own traditions with Manoman.
We make a dressing, a stuffing, wild rice, Italian sausage, pancetta, and red pepper. That's a staple for our Thanksgiving. A natural with wild rice is walnuts, onions, mushrooms. You can almost, just by saying that, taste it.
Manoman draws its taste from the beauty of its surroundings. The light, wind, and water of northern Minnesota produce a food that has sustained generations. As for the pot on the stove,
it's there. We'll just turn it off and cover it and let it sit for a few minutes.
Jenny Cecil Moore is a Seattle radio producer whose work explores culture, art, food, and history. She's currently covering the story of endangered foods in the United States. And a special thanks to Northern Community Radio in Bemidji, Minnesota. Now, for more information about this story and to get Marsha Levine's wild rice recipes, head to the website splendidtable.org. And while you're there, look for a wild rice pilaf recipe from our pals at America's Test Kitchen. It's part of their Thanksgiving celebration menu, and it's just for you. Coming up, my favorite part of the show, talking to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It's time to turn to your calls brought to you by Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods. Let's talk. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Who's up first? We have got Anna on the phone from Louisville, Kentucky. Anna, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. We belong to a local CSA, which I absolutely love. And this time of year, we get all sorts of great cold weather produce, including greens and root vegetables.
Right.
Lately, though, we've gotten a lot of radishes. And they're excellent radishes. We've gotten watermelon radishes. We've gotten daikon radishes. But I'm starting to run out of ideas on what to do with the radishes.
Well, you know, one thing that I've discovered, I was going back to my Chinese cooking days, and one thing I discovered was pickling radishes
and doing them with rice vinegar or any other mild vinegar. You could do it with cider too. But rice vinegar, a little bit of sugar, okay, and hot spices. Okay, so you slice the radish. And by the way, they turn pink because as they sit in this, you just stick this in the refrigerator and you can have it for a couple of weeks. And, you know, if you just leave it for a couple of hours, it's ready to eat and it's crunchy and it's so good on a sandwich, or better yet, as it would be served as a condiment. You know, you have the roast chicken, you have a few of these to crunch on, and they're an accent. I do a Asian rice noodle salad where I soak the rice noodles and I put in lots of vegetables and greens, and then I chop up these radishes and toss them into it. And they're fabulous. They go into almost any salad, Western style or Asian style. But you would use hot chili. You would use a little bit of star anise or just anise seed, not too much because it's very, very strong. You would use black peppercorns and you would use salt. And then you have to hit the balance right in terms of taste your way to the amount of vinegar and sugar you like.
Okay.
So now you can't keep it forever. You know, it's not meant to be kept forever. It's a fresh pickle.
Right.
But for a week or so, you're home free.
Interesting. Now, would that work with both daikons and the watermelon radishes we have?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. And the other thing is, by the way, they're great with things like smoked ham and turkey and that kind of thing. They really give it a kick. And
well, we are in the right state for that. So.
Yes, you sure are. You sure are. And I would say the other thing is the daikon radish, if you shred that with equal amounts of carrot and a bit of onion, and look up online the dipping sauce that is used for Vietnamese spring rolls. That's the dressing, and you make a great salad that way.
Oh.
I mean, like a couple of cups of shredded daikon, a couple of cups of shredded carrot, a bit of thin, thin sliced onion, and toss it with that dipping sauce, stick it in the fridge for a couple of hours, and it's just fabulous.
Oh, that sounds awesome. Yeah, I recently come back from a trip from Vietnam, and so I've been missing some of those flavors, and so I was really excited about these, but, you know, was not quite finding any great ideas. So that sounds amazing.
Yeah, you've probably had something like this while you were there. So I think you're gonna keep those radishes going.
All right, well, perfect.
Well, you take care. Thanks for a great question.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
We've got Mary Alice from Atlanta. Mary Alice, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am very good. I hope you are well, too. What's on your mind?
So I have a question about pecans. I am from Alabama. I currently live in Georgia.
Uh-huh.
So I'm no stranger. I do love them. I usually cook with pecan oil, and I recently purchased some pecan butter.
Ooh.
So I have a question about how you would incorporate them into recipes, any fun new cooking techniques you may have.
Oh, boy.
I'm very open to trying new things.
Well, first of all, I think anywhere that you have peanut butter used, you know, there's a wonderful, in Southeast Asia and in China, you find these sauces with peanut butter in them, ground peanuts. Mm. And usually the mixture is this. There's a dish, I think it's more Indonesian, but anyway, it's called satay. Have you ever heard of it?
I have.
Yeah, well, this is really a cool dish because you can do a lot of variations. It is pieces of, bite-sized pieces of pork or chicken or beef, anything. I mean, it could be fish, that you marinate with a bit of sugar, a bit of soy sauce, some garlic, and if you want, a little bit of vinegar. And then
that sounds delicious.
If it's fish, you marinate a half hour. If it's anything else, you can marinate it for hours, okay? And then you, on the side, you make this sauce, which is a combination of ground garlic, okay? I like a chunky peanut butter, so you've got a pecan butter. Whether it's smooth or not doesn't really matter, but the pecan butter would go in there, some chopped pecans, more soy sauce, sugar, garlic, and a bit of vinegar, and if you have it, a bit of rice wine, and that would be in an Asian store. And it is something that is very delicious. And you make this combination, so it has a lot of savory qualities. You know, you kind of taste the soy, et cetera, but it has this sweet quality, and then it has spice in it. It usually has some bit of chili in it to taste. And you just set that aside. Some people boil it and then cool it down. You grill the skewered pieces of meat or fish under the broiler in a, you know, in a skillet or on the outdoor grill. And then you serve that with this sauce on the side. And it's delicious. And then
love it.
That sauce, by the way, tossed with noodles, maybe with some chopped fresh scallion in it, and maybe some chopped pecans. Fabulous.
That sounds wonderful. So Thank you so much.
I think it's going to be really a nice treat for you. So anywhere you see peanut butter used, you do the pecans. And I think you'll like it a lot.
That's great.
Hey,
thank you.
Thanks for a great question, because I think there are a lot of people in your neck of the woods who have an abundance of pecans, you know, right now.
Definitely.
You enjoy them. Take care.
Thanks, Lynn. Bye-bye.
Bye. Now remember, you can reach us anytime at 800-537-5252. We love hearing from you, so come on, get in touch. Well, believe it or not, pumpkin pie is not everybody's favorite Thanksgiving dessert. So in the spirit of being fair, we're checking in with Tucker Shaw from America's Test Kitchen to discuss an alternative dessert for your Thanksgiving spread.
Tucker Shaw, nice to talk to you.
Hi, Sally. It's good to be back.
So I found out that you guys made a visit to one of my favorite bakeries in the country, Magpie Bakery in Philadelphia.
That's right.
You were on a research trip.
That's right. Our food editor, Brian Roof, spent a few days in Philadelphia, and one of the best days that he spent there was at Magpie, which is a pie bakery in South Philly.
So Holly Ricciardi, who owns it, is from the Pennsylvania Dutch countryside.
That's right. She grew up west of Philadelphia and had a very successful career as a designer. But then partway through her career, she decided to take a little bit of a detour and go into baking, which was her first love.
And she does very interesting takes on classics, one of which is Dutch apple pie.
That's right. And we thought that this Dutch apple pie was a fantastic addition to the Thanksgiving menu.
So explain to me what Dutch apple is.
Dutch apple pie is really simple. First of all, it's probably not Dutch. As you know, Pennsylvania Dutch really, really comes from the word Deutsch, which signifies German. So this is from German immigrants who lived in that part of the country. It's a single crust pie, so just a crust on the bottom, filled, stacked with slices of apple, and then covered with a crumbly streusel top. And we just love crumbles at Cook's Country, so we knew we were going to be bananas for this pie. The beautiful thing about this pie is that you don't have to pre-bake the crust, and you don't have to pre-cook the apples. You start with a very simple pie crust that has a little bit of sour cream in it so that you get a little bit of that tang. Give it a chill, roll it out, and, you know, slide it into your pie shell to receive the apples.
Mm-hmm. And then what kind of apples do you guys prefer?
So you can get really crazy with apples, right? I mean, there's a million varieties of apples out there. But we loved this pie with Golden Delicious. We loved it with Fuji. We loved it with Braeburn. We loved it with Granny Smith. Personally, Golden Delicious were my favorite because they just have a subtle sharpness, not a really strong tart flavor. And they also take sugar and create a very nuanced sweetness that I really find lovely.
Okay, well, that surprises me, I have to say. I've not heard anyone stick up for Golden Delicious in a long time. So you are a cheerleader for the underdog once again, Tucker Shaw.
Why not? I mean, hey, they're available everywhere, and they deserve some love. So you slice up your Golden Delicious apples into quarter-inch slices, and you toss them with granulated sugar, some lemon juice, a little bit of cinnamon, and our secret ingredient, which is melted vanilla ice cream.
What?
That is crazy. It's a little bit crazy, but here's the thing. Dutch apple pie traditionally comes with a bit of heavy cream, but we started kind of just, you know, going nuts in the test kitchen and looking for new kinds of ingredients and different flavors that we could introduce into this pie. And melted vanilla ice cream gives you all the creaminess that you need, plus a little bit of vanilla flavor that just serves as a very, very subtle backdrop to the apples.
That is a great idea.
One little trick, make sure that you melt the ice cream before you measure it, because depending on what brand you have, it may or may not have, you know, a great deal of air whipped into it. So your measure will change once the ice cream has melted.
That's great advice.
So you toss this all together with the apples and you let them sit for about an hour. And this takes the place of pre-cooking the apples. This will soften them and make them, you know, just easy to layer into the pie very simply.
Mm-hmm.
You take your crust, which has been chilling in the fridge, and you take these apples that you've macerated and just lay them into the pie. And you want to fill it pretty tightly. Don't leave a lot of holes in there. Many recipes call for raisins, which can be controversial. So if you like raisins, toss in a few raisins, and if you don't, no shame.
Okay.
Once you've piled in the apples, you kind of want to smooth it out and make sure that they're not mounded in the center. You know, you mm-hmm. want kind of a flat pie. And then you stir together a very simple streusel topping because, you know, we love our crumbs. Flour, brown sugar, a little bit of melted butter. Cover the pie with this topping, slide it in the oven. And then about an hour and 5 or 10 minutes later, you pull it out and you have a gorgeous, gorgeous pie. And then, Sally, this is the hardest part. You have to let it sit there. And you've got to let it sit there for at least 4 hours, but we prefer overnight. And part of the reason we do recommend that you let it sit overnight is a tip that we learned from Holly herself. She says that she never sells pies made on the same day because when you're selling slices of pie, a day-old pie slices and holds its shape much, much better than a pie that's still warm from the oven.
You don't find many bakeries who refuse to sell the pie they've baked that day. That's such a great, great tip.
You know, and I think it came from experience. She learned the right way, that's exactly the perfect amount of time to wait until you slice your pie. And you don't see any denigration in the flavor or the mm-hmm. texture or anything else by letting it sit overnight in the fridge. And here's the nice thing, too, on Thanksgiving, you know, you're kind of forced to make this ahead. You don't have a choice about doing a last-minute pie here. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do this pie, you must do it a day ahead. So that kind of, you know, eases things up on Thanksgiving Day.
That's a great idea. Hey, Tucker, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw is editor-in-chief of Cook's Country. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now, you can find America's Test Kitchen's recipe for Dutch apple pie. It's on our website. You know where, splendidtable.org. Oh, and while you're there, check out our list of 15 Thanksgiving desserts that are not pumpkin pie. Now, Thanksgiving's about tradition, and Turkey Confidential has become one of our favorite Splendid Table traditions. I'll be here with my co-host Francis Lamb live for 2 hours of Thanksgiving triage on the day you need it most, Thanksgiving. Be sure to tune in to your local station or listen online. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Irma Bombeck, who said, Thanksgiving dinners take 18 hours to prepare. They are consumed in 12 minutes. Half times take 12 minutes. This is not a coincidence. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. And remember, splendidtable.org is a clearinghouse for all your Thanksgiving needs. Well, our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, and Sally Swift, well, she's our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM. American Public Media.